Hello, I'm Maeve Doyle. You're listening to A Private View on the 19th of January. We are finding our rhythm within this third lockdown, and I'm quite enthusiastic, excited, and thrill, and hopefully it speaks to education and promise. Kenny Schachter's coming back at 10:30 to do part two before he returns to New York. Today I want to talk to him a little bit more about the role of the art critic and the art writer. Last week he spoke about emerging artists' age categories moving up so that they weren't just under 30s. I also want to speak to him about the relationship between artist and collector, artist and public, and what his role as an educator is really achieving. I mean, in this world of lockdown, the one thing we know that is a place of freedom is our imagination. I wonder what he'll have to say about that. I can't think of anyone better to talk about the art world with than Kenny Schachter. His depth and breadth of knowledge and his enthusiasm for the art world is second to none. As I've said to people who didn't hear the first interview, Kenny makes me look like a mute, which is not an easy thing to do. Kenny Schachter, welcome to A Private View. Thank you for coming back. How are you today?
Thank you for having me back. Are you sure? You haven't changed your mind?
I haven't changed my mind. We're thinking of holding you hostage, so you're here all the time co-hosting the show.
Did you see me drive by in my little green M&M car?
No,
I didn't. Bianchi from 1976.
I was trying to get Dot Master on the phone, so I missed it. I wish I had
seen
it.
It's the size of a motorcycle, and maybe the fact that I parked in a motorcycle parking place will...
But this is quite interesting, because I've heard you're a car fanatic.
Well, I used to be, but I've had some bad... Everyone thinks the art world is so unregulated and so nefarious, but... I've never been sued, many threats to be sued, but the only time I ever got sued in my entire life was in relationship to a classic car situation, which is still pending and the bane of my existence. And
are the details interesting?
No. I bought a car and then someone sent me an anonymous email that my car was a fake. It would make a good book at some point.
Not your artwork, but your car.
Yeah. Anyway, it's still languishing in the courts and it's... been a painful, expensive learning curve of me learning to hate cars and the car market. The art market is tame in relationship.
The last time I talked to you, we were speaking about emerging artists and moving the boundaries for emerging artists from an age category to people who are just sort of underrepresented. And this seemed to have a collective voice from people who were chiming in going, finally, someone's addressed this issue, which underlying the issue has sexist, potentially economic class issues. If you weren't brought up by the best parents, you're not going to come into fruition of your talents until you're settled and have been able to pay for a life.
I'm a late bloomer. And I'm still waiting to come into talents, if I may have any. But art is a slow-burning process, and we live in a very fast-paced Instagram, smartphone, shortened attention span society. So, I mean, I've been doing this for 30 years in the fine art world, and I still wake up with fresh eyes every day and an appreciation of people like consensus and people like to affirm success. So the market in particular, or galleries, they're always looking for the next new sensation. And sometimes the next new sensation could be 70 years old.
For instance, Rose Wiley, you mentioned Eva Berenson, was it?
Eva Berenson. But the fact is, there's also a cynical side to the art market.
Well, I know where you're going with this.
So, I mean, the market is looking for either older African-American artists, black artists, artists of color, older women, people that art history has seemingly passed without recognition or appreciation. And then it becomes a money play where everyone's looking for, in this case, like Carmen Herrera is an artist who just turned 100 or 101. And she was late discovered and always had been making art. So, yeah, I mean, art should be appreciated and discovered for the content of the work and not for any sinister marketing strategy.
Well, on that note, brace yourself. Scott Rayburn's coined a term that I think you know, Scott Rayburn from the Art Newspaper.
I know who he is.
It's called red chip art, and it applies to people like Matthew Wong, who I know you know.
Before, red chip art meaning Asian artists?
No.
I don't know what that means.
No, I don't know what it means either.
And I need the connotation already.
Because you read color as politics. Yes, you read color as politics correctly. The symbolism.
Well, there's another thing where it's like all of a sudden the world, the art world, discovered that there are people besides white guys. And... Well, you're having some problem with your phone situation.
Don't you worry about it. I got this. You do your thing.
Anyway, the art world all of a sudden, where there's like, I mean, the art world decided that there are black people in the world other than. So anyway, there's been like a constant gold rush to exhibit the work. People are ticking boxes. I mean, in a sense, there's a benefit, an upside to the fact that galleries are now opening their eyes to the fact that there are other people in the world. George Bozulitz, one of the world's most famous and successful artists, German artist, surprise, surprise. He constantly has gone on the record saying that the reason that that women artists don't fetch similar prices in the market in relationship to their male counterparts is because women can't paint as well. And that's like a 75-year-old canonized, historically recognized artist, and he continues, and he doesn't just say it like under his breath in a cocktail party. He says it in Der Spiegel and some of Germany's most well-known media outlets.
It's amazing. It's shocking.
And also, like, I mean, one of my favorite abstract painters who just turned 81 2 weeks ago, Mary Heilman, who I did a show with when I had a project space that was designed by the conceptual artist Fido Acconci. Her auction record is only a couple hundred thousand, even though she's represented by Hauser & Wirth, the monster multi-venued international behemoth.
That is a behemoth.
Behemoth, thank you. I can't pronounce. I'm still struggling with English, even though it's my only language.
If we open that Pandora's box, we'll be here until February. Go.
Anyway, if she had a penis, her work would be selling for four times the amount that it is now. And she's just an extraordinary artist. So even though things have radically transformed over the last 5 years, even where the floodgates have been open and black artists and female artists are really at the top of their game, and there's more opportunities today for other artists besides the status quo than ever before, but they're still far from parity when you look at the 15 highest auction prices or the 15 artists that have done the best commercially over the past year, it's still going to be the majority of which are men.
So there's a few things I want to talk to you about in this small amount of time. And one of them is, and we can't pick one of them just yet because there isn't enough time. I want your life story.
No.
I want that. I also want your opinion on the auction houses and the Banksy market, which you know is insane. I also would like to have your opinion on Brexit. I also want your opinion on the difference between New York now to London and why you decided to move. I also want your opinion on what's happening with gallery spaces and private museums and Kate Blanchett opening a new art gallery.
I hate private museums.
I know you do. There's so much that I want to talk to you about. We need to get a system where you're on monthly. So
you know where
start
to find
with
me.
Whatever it is from those things that I talked
about.
Well,
private museums are generally tax dodges.
Explain to people what they are.
A private museum is when a rich collector, decides to open a quasi-public institution to present their work to the public. Ostensibly, it's meant to be open to the public and accessible. Now,
Do you want to name names?
Well, the Marciano Museum was in Los Angeles. That's a perfect example of a museum that shouldn't exist. So the Marciano family, I'm sure they're fine people, although I think one of them may have had a few issues.
But
I'm not going to get into our focus. The Marciano Museum opened in this incredible Masonic. Did I get that word right?
Yes, Masonic. Yes, that sounds like Los Angeles.
It's Masonic. In a giant Masonic temple. So if a private museum is in a jurisdiction where there are no state-run institutions grounded in academic curatorial accrual of knowledge and information, let's say in China, where there's not a big network of state-run contemporary international art museums, it makes perfect sense to have private museums. although one of them I know is started by someone who has a kind of karaoke bar slash whorehouse, but we won't get into that story either. But in Los Angeles? No, yeah, that's Shanghai. Try. That's Shanghai.
Even better.
And I wrote about that, and then the person who informed me had to go into hiding, but back to L.A.
Oh,
so,
my God, I love your John le Carré life.
Go
on. Private museums.
I know what I'm talking about. So there's in Los Angeles, you have the L.A. County Museum and the Museum of Contemporary Art, MoCA, two fantastic museums. So when you the art world, the world works on a zero-sum economic basis where, let's say, the opportunities for one artist could be at the expense of another artist. When a museum, a great museum, like the Contemporary Art Museum in Chicago, when they decide to show Virgil Abloh, who's a famous fashion designer slash DJ slash furniture designer, I'm missing a few slashes.
Yeah.
When a great museum gives over their space to a fashion designer, or when Tom Krenz, who used to run the Guggenheim, gives over his museum to motorcycles, which he loves, or fashion, Giorgio Armani, who are paying the bills, that means artists can't show during that month. In one of the museums have only a small handful of shows a year. And there's only a handful of audience, even though it's larger than sports events, that patronize museums. So if there's a museum like the Marciano Museum, they started Guess Jeans and they started collecting maybe 10, 15 years ago. So it's really like it's curatorship without being grounded in academics and the study and connoisseurship of art. So anyway, if there's a Marciano Museum, which I've been to myself before it closed, that means your time is only so much. So oftentimes people will go see the Marciano Museum instead of LACMA or MoCA, the two state-run institutions that have built a constituency over decades and painstakingly raised money to create the resources to have a museum in Los Angeles. Los Angeles is a great town that's chock-a-block full with galleries and great state public institutions. And there's another museum, Eli Broad. And he's a very rich man who is in the insurance and home business.
Great collector.
Yeah, no, he's not. His collection is a Sotheby's and Christie's night sale collection. So it's a box-ticking collection with a lot of art acquired at very high-profile public auctions. So if he didn't open his own museum, and he has some great pieces in it, if he didn't open his own museum, he would have contributed all that art, donated it to one of the two museums in town. Los Angeles does not need a private museum. There were 75 employees at the Marciano Museum, and last year they decided to unionize so they would not be because they were being paid subpar wages. In their effort to unionize, the family just turned around and shut the museum. And I mean, they're working with, like, I would call the collection is more comprised, put together by an art advisor than,
Who's the advisor?
Oh, I don't know. It's been probably a series of them. But they closed, and now Gagosian took over the building. I would much rather have Gagosian take over this fabulous building because he's very transparent. And Gagosian has done, I mean, we've had a hate-love, love-hate relationship, but he's one of the he's an incredible art dealer, and he's done
incredible.
He kept John Richardson, the foremost preeminent Picasso scholar, on the payroll for 10 years, even though John Richardson may have done three or four shows, because to make a show of the quality that of Picasso that they staged, three or four of them in the gallery over the years, takes many years and is very difficult to get loans from people. And in any event, museums are so cash strapped for money. I'd rather see a gallery which is transparent in their commercial ambitions than one of these pseudo fake museums. So anyway, when the Rubels first started a museum in Miami, their own museum, there were no major museums for contemporary art. The problem is with private museums are that, they buy and sell regularly, and they often engage in this. They're just collectors clothed in this kind of pseudo institution. And as a result, they get to deduct the money for rent, for the upkeep of their collection, for insurance, for transportation. And there's one in Maryland, in the suburbs somewhere, the Rails Museum, Mitch Rails, who's a hedge funder, and his wife, I think Emily. Anyway, they're known to be extraordinary collectors, but the museum is like, you need to make an appointment. It's completely inaccessible geographically. So these things, the benefits in terms of like depriving taxpayers of more money, I would say, do not outweigh the benefit of having an institution like that when there are great museums in the area of Maryland, Virginia, and Washington, D.C.
So I'm going to roll it back, and I'm going to suggest that you and I both started in the art world when it was for geeks in black with notebooks, moleskin notebooks, who maybe smoked outside. When did these finance people and...
Well, there's been
muscling their way.
There's
into
been
the
more
art world.
Growth,
and what's the effect?
There's been more growth financially in the art world in the last 20 years than the previous 200 years, and people think that art and money as bedfellows is a recent phenomenon. But Rembrandt was so obsessed with money. There's a book called Rembrandt's Enterprise by Svetlana Alpers, who's a Columbia scholar professor, and he was so obsessed with money. His studio assistants painted coins on the floor in an effort to get him to bend over to pick them up and pocket them. And he also had the biggest house in Amsterdam, collected, I mean, it almost sounds like Damien Hirst, who can't paint like Rembrandt, but he's made some extraordinary art in his life. And anyway, so Rembrandt ended up going bankrupt during an economic downturn, and in the end of his life couldn't even accept commissions in his own name because his wages were garnished. Anyway, art and money have always been in bed together, but the kind of monetization of art has exploded because of a number of reasons, mainly like, some very high profile prices fetched at auction. Also, art has become kind of imbued with social cachet, and also things like freeports where you can store your art in this kind of autonomous city state of you don't have to pay VAT or sales tax when you buy art and you keep it in one of these state-sanctioned warehouses.
Stop there.
No.
Yes. Because what I want to ask you is this what people would say is a gateway for finance people to move things around?
Drug money laundering and...
And does it compromise
corruption and criminality?
The quality of culture that we're putting out?
You know,
the art world...
The world is the world, and the art world reflects nothing. I mean... I'm
right,
very laissez-faire and very open-ended. And I think if people get into art for money, first of all, someone once said in relationship to the car industry, if you want to make a small fortune in the automotive industry, start with a large one. And a lot of the people who get into art simply to make money end up losing money, although Gagosian gets horny by doing a big deal.
But he's a complicated character.
He's
and
great,
he was mentored by a Castelli. There's a lot going on.
No, it's true. They worked together, and that was just a brilliant strategic alliance where they both derived benefits from it. But that's yet another story. Anyway, art has become, because of free ports where you can trade art without paying any taxes, so it reduces the cost. And there's a lot of financing now on collections because there's $1 trillion of art in circulation, but art, of course, does not create any income. But now you're able to finance off of it, and interest rates are so low. Anyway, and also because of greater transparency in the market and the increase in the breadth of the market due to things like social media. And anyway, so there's a lot of variables, a perfect storm, that have contributed to art being treated more like a financial asset. And it's been subsequently monetized to an extent that it never has been. And also you have prices like the Prince of Saudi Arabia paying $450 million for Leonardo da Vinci to whitewash his murderous reputation. And he didn't. If I was a journalist in Saudi Arabia, I would be turned into sushi roll. But I don't.
And so on that note, I know that you've been around long enough to know when Banksy pieces were going for a few hundred quid and pest control didn't exist. This isn't something you're going to want to talk about, but I want you to talk about.
Why wouldn't I want to talk about
what
it?
Is going on with an edition of 600 prints selling for hundreds of thousands of pounds each with Bomb Hugger and the napalm and just the Banksy piece. I mean, we were working with Banksy in the 2000s. These pieces weren't expensive. There was no pest control.
Good for him.
No.
But what is
going on with the auction houses? Because they seem to have a private museum. He seems to have a private museum at Sotheby's.
Well, he consigns things directly to Sotheby's, which again,
if he doesn't exist, how
new.
Can he consign things?
I mean,
things?
David Hammond's one of the great conceptual artists in the world today. He's been doing that. I mean, Hogarth had a sale of his own work at auction in the late 1700s, or I may get my dates wrong. But
no, but I like what you're saying. You're saying event, they've cut out the middleman, and
listen,
it's very
Banksy
interesting.
Is a good artist, and yeah, I think he's really artist. Funny. There are certain too. Other street artists that you can relate him to, one of which is Cause. And Cause work, I despise because it's conceptually vacuous.
But there's also Daumier, who you could relate.
Yeah, of course, yes. But I'm not saying that. I'm just saying, like, Banksy, I think, good for him. He's extraordinarily clever, and I think I really appreciate his sense of humor. I don't like everything he did. Like, I mean, I just think he's, you know, the shredding, the painting shredding at the end of auction. I tried to buy the painting immediately after it was shredded from Sotheby's, and I would tend to think that Sotheby's was in on the spectacle. But in any event, people...
There was a documentary made. Of course, yeah, they
people are sheep in the art world, and there's a herd mentality that drives prices. When it's $5,000, nobody cares. When it's $50,000, people start to whisper. And when it's $500,000, everybody wants one. So when Banksy achieves a high price at auction, then everyone comes out of the woodwork and the prices escalate. That's just human nature.
So what is that about Banksy? People applauding the price
and
not
also,
the
like,
art?
Everyone sort of knows who Banksy is.
Yes.
He's like Robin Gunderson, and it's been written about from the Daily Mail.
Gunningham.
And I used to live... Whatever.
Gotcha.
Whatever.
Who did I call what?
Whatever. Anyway, what I'm saying is that it's like Santa Claus. Nobody wants... It's impossible. Anonymity in the day and age of social media is next to impossible. Everyone's walking around with their pants down. Everyone's listening to your conversations, reading, bugging your phone. And I mean, every time they say, Steve Wozniak, one of the founders of Apple, he said on record that every time you download an app, your entire phone, the security of your phone is breached. But anyway,
so where does this leave the art world in terms of brain implants and artificial?
The more transparency in the art world, the better. I love it. Banksy is funny and he's clever and he's a good artist. What I didn't like, I mean, sometimes there's a lot of hypocrisy in the art world, and that's really what I rail against, and I'm guilty of it myself. I'm far from a little perfect bunny.
Yeah, but you happily self-deprecate everything about yourself and admit to being human.
What I didn't like about Banksy was, like, he bought a refugee boat.
Oh,
and
yeah, that
the
was
boat was like an ancient boat, and he decided to save all the immigrants fleeing from, you know, oppressed countries and working their way towards the West to seek opportunities. And it's a great gesture, but
not thought out very well.
But then he bought an old boat, and then he had, of course, plaster one of his own artworks on the boat. So already it's like, you know, when people, there's no such thing as altruism, probably. And a lot of donations are like, there's the wing of the hospital by Mr. and Mrs. Blah. And if he really wanted to help people, he would just get a boat, one that preferably worked better than his did. But so many people went on the boat when it first went to sea that it malfunctioned. But then he had a gigantic Banksy plastered on the side of it. So, I mean, if you want to do something, which is an extraordinary gesture of great charity, and not only just like putting your money where your mouth is, but again, like, he had to brand the boat with his artwork. So then I made a video in our piece where I was drowning in the sea and a boat came by festooned with Cause pieces. And I just said, no thanks, and drowned, that I'd rather drown than get aboard the Cause rescue boat. But also, I'm going to say something else, which is terrible. Like, back to opportunities for Black artists and how the market is changing. And David Zwirner, who doesn't have many Black artists at all.
A director.
Except for Kerry James Marshall, who is the market, has a world record for a Black artist at over $20 million, an extraordinary paint. I mean, he's a painter.
I love him.
Zaha Hadid
sweet.
Hated to be called an Arab female architect. And I just think art should be art, and we shouldn't have to assign this kind of nomenclature, a Black artist, a white artist, a women artist, a trans artist, a they artist, a this or that. I don't want to get myself
into
trouble.
And we wouldn't have had to do it. Were they not excluded?
Yeah, that's true.
But so we had to do it because they were excluded.
But David Zwirner, what he thinks is like a do-gooder gesture, is opening a Black gallery. So,
oh, dear.
Yeah, oh, dear is right. So he hired a Black director. And
named Ebony.
Yeah, whatever. And she... I would presume that she has some proprietary interest in the company, but nevertheless, like, for a white German to be opening a Black gallery is just has the worst for me. I mean, first of all, if he wanted to do something helpful, it's just like Banksy. Why not just quietly finance the gallery as an investor without going on record, because he's trying to get all the accolades of being this open-minded, equanimous.
Is your
some
criticism
elocution
of,
lessons? I think I just think people should do
egos?
Stuff. I mean, when I was curating shows in the 90s, I would just always I mean, it would have been so easy to have 10 guys in the show, but I would never do that. I mean, because I've always been someone who looks to be fair in any way that I can. I try to be.
And how did you get?
I always made an effort without publicizing it or making reference to it. That I would just include different artists.
But it isn't even an effort with you. It is the way you are.
Well,
you're inclusive.
Yes, and I think being inclusive and mentoring people and being amenable towards helping people in any way I can, I get as much satisfaction to teaching and writing and making art the same way that someone like Gagosian gets off making a sale for $10 million. I mean, that does nothing for me.
Have you seen him on the sales floor?
I had dinner with him
after like arena.
I was after like after being enemies, frenemies, and he used to hate me. I once did an article where somebody quit the company Goldman Sachs, and they wrote an op-ed article why they left Goldman Sachs, and it was like a whiny on.
And I know the person.
I was going to relate it to the culture. He was saying that the culture of investment banking has changed, that the investment banks have become, they're engaging in proprietary trading at the expense of their relationships with their clients. So my point was to, I was going to write an article and say the art galleries used to nurture relationships. They would build collections organically, and the collections would be bequeathed to subsequent generations. And then I realized like art dealers are often trading for their own account, and the people that suffer are the clients. And the art market, art dealers behave like an Egyptian sculpture with both hands outstanded in opposite directions doing this dance. And they're getting paid from the buyer and the seller, and neither of whom are aware of this kind of agency relationship between both parties. Anyway, so I took this article and I was going to relate it.
Now.
But it was a really long article, and I ended up just, every time it said Goldman Sachs, I substituted Gagosian. And every time it said like a derivative, I said selling an unwieldy Jason Rhodes or Mike Kelly sculpture. And I just did this, and then it was picked up by a newsletter, and then it went viral, a couple of 100,000 hits. And to this day, like 9 years later, I still get stopped in the street of people telling me that I inspired them to quit their job and move on.
So Kenny, if you don't know, and I'm sure you all know, covers the universe. And so if I read a book and see Kenny's name and I photograph it and send it to Kenny, he doesn't always know about it because everyone refers to the things that Kenny says.
Well,
generous. When is there a documentary coming out about your life and how the art world saved you, which is something that you say a lot?
Yeah.
Or occasionally.
I mean, we spoke about Inigo Philbrick, and you pronounced his name wildly incorrectly, I might add.
I did it just to get a rise out of
it. Inigo, I think you called it.
Are we doing this?
We're doing this.
Okay.
You
were hanging out with Maiden Chelsea?
What I am saying is...
and you have the nerve to criticize me?
I'm not criticizing you. I'm loving you in my
I
own
like it. Same.
Fashion.
Same. Yeah.
Anyway, so I wrote an article about this young person who stole an awful lot of money from many rich people. And I wouldn't care if he just stole money from me because we had a good friendship beforehand and a relationship. But then
everybody take note.
I introduced him to some people and he stole money from them. And the way he rationalized it really incensed me. And I wrote this article about the nature of our relationship and his behavior, a lot of which was I was the only one privy to it. And I wrote an article in New York Magazine. It got picked up in the Saturday Magazine section of the Times. And I had calls from 10 plus movie companies and producers who wanted to do both a documentary and a scripted movie. And I was thinking long and hard about it, and I decided, well, I had a couple of calls, one of whom was interesting, who was a producer of, he produced the Fyre Festival on Netflix and was a producer of the Tiger King documentary, and he had gone to art school. And over the course of our discussions, I made a very clear decision that I was not going to spend six months of my life going on and on about someone who robbed me. And he represented all the greed and the bad part of the art world. But I wanted to tell the story that the art world gives me hope, fills me with passion, imbues me with love. And I was able to basically shift this documentary around to like the art world through my eyes and through my relationships. After speaking to you, I'm going to see Tracy Emin's show at YQ. We got permission to open the show speak to her.
Yeah. You haven't seen it.
No, I have not. So anyway, sure, there's a lot of shit that goes on in the art world, and a lot of people are screwing each other. I always say in the art world, they stab you in the front, and then you have dinner with them because you can't afford to alienate someone you could do another deal with.
And I agree.
But it's just a bell's curve of morality and ethics in the world, and the art world is no different. It reflects everything socially, politically, economically, and psychologically in the world. So I think there's a lot of good, and art is literally helps me get up in the morning now that I quit drinking and doing drugs. I rely on art to basically sustain me.
Couple of things. I can't imagine you getting up in the morning because I can't imagine you going to bed, which is fine. But with that said, I think I agree entirely with what you said. We ate the time. How do we do this on a regular basis? Because the listeners love it. We can do it from New York. We can figure out your insomnia.
I'd be happy
schedule.
To come like once a week, whenever. I can get up at any
Course
time.
Korsh and I can absolutely arrange that. And it would be an honor.
I teach all the time. I mentor all the time. And it means a lot to me to give people, I don't think that I'm making people like affirm the worst parts of the art world. I think I'm inspiring people to just see through it all and to see that, you know, like I said, I love art and art fills me with hope every time I wake up in the morning.
And the complexities are part of it. Kenny Schachter, thank you for joining A Private View. Korsh Adhomi, thank you for producing. We've reached the end, but you heard the commitment. Kenny's coming on regularly. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Soho Radio. Goodbye for now. See you Friday.